I'm probably the oldest. That's pretty old, dude.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call to order this hearing of the House Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. A quorum is present. Thank you all for your promptness. So, as you know, yesterday we did a walkthrough of House File 4247 as amended, which is our minibus, as we're calling it, with licensing and scope of practice provisions. So, we're going to start with markup on that bill today. So, I'm going to move that House File 4247, as amended by the DE3, be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. So, being at that place now, we have several amendments that have been filed, and I would like to start by taking up the A4 amendment. And just so members know, we have sort of a series of three more or less technical amendments that I'd like to take up, and then we'll move to the more substantive amendments. So the A4 amendment, so I would move the A4 amendment. This is some changing of dates and some cleanup to the vet tech portion of the bill. And so any questions or comments to the A4 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of adoption of the A4 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. To the A5 amendment, I'm going to move adoption of the A5 amendment. And this is another technical amendment, changing effective dates. This was a request of the Board on Marriage and Family Therapy to their portion of the bill. And I think it just had to do with their ability to get things up and running by the dates that were in the original underlying bill. So any discussion to this? Seeing none, all in favor of adoption of the A5 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted. And then finally, I would like to move the A6 amendment, and this amendment was brought to us by our staff, who, we are so appreciative that they pay such close attention and read everything, and they catch errors occasionally, and that's what this represents, some errors that were brought by the staff. So any questions or discussion to the A6? Seeing none, all in favor of adoption of the A6 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. Okay, thank you, members. So the next amendment would be the A3 amendment. And I think that might be Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Did you want to offer the A3 amendment, Representative Nadeau?
Yes, no. I am authoring. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, and I'm sorry I was confused. I was just talking with Representative Edelson, and I'm going to pull that amendment from consideration.
All right, thank you. So that amendment will not be offered. Okay, thank you. Okay, next we have the A2 amendment. Did someone want to offer the A2?
Madam Chair, I will move the A2 amendment.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This amendment extends the temporary nursing license from 60 to 90 days. We've been hearing back in our communities, Laverne in particular, and from some of our health care providers that the nurses that come into the state often will have the temporary license expire before they're able to get their full licensure. And it's my understanding that the Minnesota Board of Nursing supports this, stating that this would reduce the number of instances where nurses' temporary permit expires before they have completed all they need to obtain full licensure. This would have the benefits for them and their employers, as it would avoid breaks in licensure. We hope that we could see this as a good quality fix for the lives of our nurses, our boards, and our communities, and I hope it's viewed as a friendly amendment. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Schumacher. So I don't know if does anyone else want to speak to the amendment? Okay, so I would ask members to oppose the amendment. I also checked with the Board of Nursing, and my understanding is that they are neutral on the amendment. There are a lot of problems with this, with doing this. First of all, we didn't have a hearing on it, so it's always difficult when we are doing things on the fly and we didn't have the parties in front of us. And of course, that's an issue of, on any time anybody wants to add new provisions to an omnibus bill like this. But, I'm hearing actually that the Board of Nursing is improving its time to being able to process licenses. And one of the problems with this amendment, which just expands the number of days that someone can work here under a temporary permit, is it shifts the balance in terms of labor relationships with hospitals and nurses, and makes it easier to bring in and have temporary nurses in the state to break strikes and that kind of thing. And while some of you might think that's an okay thing, some others might not think it's an okay thing. And so without a hearing on this, I'm going to recommend a no vote. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We saw during the pandemic that there are occurrences of where you need to bring in staff for a period of time. And frankly, Minnesota is an outlier in that most states are part of the compact. And we've had difficulty with staffing, as in having enough people to cover and support our needs. So I think this is a reasonable way of trying to bridge until we actually wake up and realize that we should join the majority of the states in having a unified licensure and mobility so that we can quickly respond if need be. So I humbly disagree with your position. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. All in favor of the A2 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion does not prevail. The amendment is not adopted. And finally, we have the A1 amendment. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm far less confused now, so thank you. I'm offering the A1 amendment, which is, it is acknowledging the effort and the progress, the massive progress we've made to increase, patient access to eye care, plus updating a long overdue optometry scope of practice. This amendment is pretty short and simple. It removes some restrictions around injections and medications around oral antivirals and glaucoma. Minnesota is a bit of an outlier, as everyone knows, in optometry care, but this amendment improves access to eye care and makes us far more competitive for people coming out of school. Currently, students in 22 schools across the country are taught, trained, and tested on care and procedures that are far above what our scope of practice allows them in Minnesota right now. So we're finally starting to lose those bright young doctors to other states, including the neighboring states, that all have a better scope of practice. We've become a bit of an island. So finally, members, there's overwhelming support to this amendment. 15 members of this committee have either signed on or are co-author of this bill. I think it's time we move this issue forward. We assist patients in Minnesota who have been waiting for far too long, so I hope people want to talk to this amendment, and I hope we can support it.
Okay. Is there any discussion? Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Nadeau, for bringing the issue up to talk about in this committee. I would really like to find a resolution to this issue this session. I have had this bill for 6 years now, and I'm getting to know optometrists and ophthalmologists quite well. This is the first session, though, where there has been real progress between the parties to find the sometimes elusive peace in the valley, which will be the best outcome. And so right now I don't want to go into the specifics about the procedures being debated, but will say there needs to be some change made. What I do want to report to all of you is that I've been following the negotiations, and I did hear positive news both last night and this morning that we have people talking, a new offer on the table, and that the Senate sounds like we'll be putting this bill in to conference committee. So I am asking that we continue to let the process work a bit longer. We still have options ahead of us, but I thank you for bringing the amendment up.
All right, Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I will say that on this particular amendment, I appreciate the spirit and the understanding here, and I know that the parties have been working to try to find a path forward for quite some time. In looking at the content of the amendment, there is still one provision in particular that still gives me great pause, and I've been very public about that in the past. I have real concerns about the impact of intravitreal injections and what could that could mean if it goes wrong for the patient. And I think one of the things we always talk about is do no harm. And I have real concerns about that piece. I know the parties are working together to find solutions. And I would also encourage that we let that play out as they continue to have those conversations. So I would urge members to vote no.
Thank you, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Bierman's comments are, I guess, I'm glad that there's a discussion. But if that ends up being like past years, would Representative Bierman support an amendment like this on the House floor to the final version of the bill, since we in committee have discussed this and apparently a large portion of our committee is informed enough to be a co-author? I just don't want to end up having another year of where, they're coming close and nothing happens. So that's my query.
So I would just say that members do not have to answer how they might vote in the future on anything. So Representative Bierman, if you care to respond, you may, but you certainly aren't.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I will just say the key words in your statement was an amendment like this. And from my conversations last night, the wording of this is not what we're looking at or they're discussing. So I will say, you know, it would depend on the wording, and that is something I do want to pass the bill, as I stated at the beginning. We need a resolution. They're working on some changes, and that's what I will support. Thanks.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Quam. To my knowledge, we haven't had a full hearing on this in this session. Perhaps you had previous sessions before I was here, so I haven't had the benefit of hearing all the arguments. I have been talking with both sides. I appreciate Representative Bierman's approach to this, and I would encourage you to side with him, and we can just continue to work on it. Thank you.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just felt compelled to speak about this because this is one of those things coming into the legislature I didn't know much about. And then I've talked to practitioners on both sides in my district and really enjoyed those conversations. And I do hope for a peace in the valley, as Representative Bierman said. I do share Representative Bonner's concerns, particularly around injection authority. And I do think it's worth saying, because we hear this a lot, that we are an outlier, and we take that case by case, but sometimes it is good for us to have higher standards than a lowest common denominator. We in this committee, all of us, want to protect the people of Minnesota in health scope of practice. And so we need to take these issues by issues. There are things in here that I would support, but I think today, in this particular way, I am going to vote no on that, but I am hopeful that in our conference committee we can get something closer to the middle on this. So I just wanted to explain that, and thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just briefly, I want to thank you, Representative Bierman, for working so hard on this issue. And my hope and my encouragement is to say that, yes, we are looking for peace in the Valley. That is always the best way to do things around here. But sometimes we don't get peace in the Valley until we tell interested parties we are doing something. So whether you choose to come to an agreement, or whether you choose to be on the sideline, we will do something. And I hope that you are demanding of the two sides in this situation. I just use the example, you know, I get it, you know, the folks on this side of the table represent a lot of rural communities. And I will give the example. My father-in-law, once a month, travels 1 hour from his home for injectables for his macular degeneration. He does not have an option closer to home. He is 89 years old. That's why this issue is critical, to figure out what that is, because we have folks, particularly in rural communities, who need access to care. And so I hope you will be demanding with the two sides and say we are doing something. So you can either be at the table or not, but let's do something. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Final word, Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a clarification, Representative Bonner, this amendment did still exclude intravitreal injections. This amendment did. I just wanted to make that clear. And to the body, to the members, thank you for, you know, having this discussion. I've learned more about you know, vitreous gelatinous substances than I ever thought possible. But I'm going to withdraw my A1 and thank Representative Bierman for working so hard and continuing to bring these people to the table. I think it's been a good conversation. I think we all recognize that there's things that we need to do, and hopefully we're going to do it this session. So with that, I withdraw my amendment, Madam Chair.
All right, the A1 is withdrawn, and so we are going to be back in the bill. I just would like to comment that this issue is really illustrative of the problem that we face with all of these licensing and scope issues, because we around these tables are usually not experts on these particular issues. We all want to access for Minnesota patients. We all want practitioners to be able to practice and make a living. And we also want to make sure that safety and high standards are maintained so that when people do get care, that it's high quality care that really does what it's supposed to do. So it's often very difficult for us to balance these issues, and I appreciate everyone's coming to the table, because it is best for all if the people who understand this the best figure out the answers so that we all don't make mistakes. That's what we don't want to do, is make mistakes. That's why we want them to tell us what the answers should be. But sometimes people do need a push, as has been stated. Okay, so we are back on House File 4247 as amended. Is there any discussion to the bill as amended? All right, seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 4247 as amended be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the bill, as amended, is on its way to Ways and Means. Thank you all very much. Okay. The next bill on the agenda for today is House File 4600, Representative Hewitt. And I will move that House File 4600 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. So I understand there's an author's amendment. Let me just, a lot of paper today. Okay. So there's the A1-1 amendment. So I think this is an amendment to get the bill in the order in which the author would like to have it discussed. So why don't we adopt the amendment, and then the author, as part of, if that's okay, Representative Hewitt, as part of your discussion can
Madam Chair, that is correct.
All right, very good. So I will move the A1-1 amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The A1-1 is adopted. So Representative Hewitt, your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Backer, for recently signing on to this bill. This is one we totally agree on. This meets the recruitment, retention part, and right person, right place, right time. Basically what this is it opens up and gives the current EMSRB or future the right to work with the licensing realms. It removes skill testing for an RN to do an EMT. It provides a hardship to BLS ambulances allowing for EMT staffing. It allows recertification of EMRs. It allows community paramedics 48 months after registration expiration to recertify. It also allows EMTs, AMTs, and community paramedics, if they've expired, to get reinstated up to almost 10 years, and I'll explain this in a second why we went there. And there's some educational requirements we put in here. Also, the amendment, what it touches on is we have a lot of flight nurses that work as in the capacity of EMS, and by statute they can't work in an ambulance, which is bizarre. I've worked with a lot of more of my time. So the one thing that I know that a lot of people are wondering about is what about this expired licensing issue? One of the things our task force found out in our smaller conversations were that, you know, I let my license expire during COVID. I kind of regret that now. Is there any way possible we can open up the doors to let me come back in? We're doing anything and everything for recruitment and retention in EMS. This is a total bipartisan situation here. So I say we take whoever we can. I know the chair and I have had discussions. The big part about this is that even though they do the training, so they're going to have to go do the refreshers that they missed, they're going to have to go back through some skill testing, but they also will have to be signed off by a medical director, which is really important to this task. So with that, Madam Chair, I do have Mr. McAlpin from the Ambulance Association here to testify on the bill also.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Mr. McAlpin.
Madam Chair, members, Buck McAlpin, representing the Minnesota Ambulance Association. We've worked with the Regulatory Board, Representative Hewitt, and the stakeholders on this piece of legislation for probably the last year. The legislative committee of both our association and the Regulatory Board, we meet and discuss some of these issues. Representative Hewitt's spot on. Trying to go back, you know, last year our Regulatory Board did an audit, showed about 50% of our EMTs under 35 didn't recertify. That's alarming for the workforce. So we want to give some opportunities to go out and try to find some of the paramedics and EMTs and try to give them an opportunity to come back into the workforce and try to streamline some of the process with their medical directors to be recertified. So we're very supportive of this legislation and appreciate your support today.
All right, thank you. Discussion to, oh, I should first ask, is there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill? Okay, not seeing anyone. Discussion, Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hewitt. Yeah, I would agree. This, one of the things that we heard out in the task force is recruitment. And, I mean, there is more work that we can do, as we know that we as EMTs have no pensions or anything like that. That's a different discussion. Though this is a good start, because one of the things many years ago that 3 years ago that I started working on is just a registered nurse to be able to run with the service. We know that, Buck and I, we've talked about that several times, and then also having a PA. At the end of the day, we have to enlarge the pool, and we need to get more people into the field, but that is a very good start. I do like this bill, like Representative Hewitt said. I did sign on to it. It is a good step with recruitment. It's not a tourniquet. We're applying direct pressure to the problem, as all SEM teams would know what I mean by that. We do have to fix the problem, but this is a good way to stop and slow down the bleed. So thank you, Representative Hewitt. Very much appreciative on this bill. It helps out in a lot of ways, so thank you.
Thank you, Representative Backer. So I do have a question, just maybe for Mr. McAlpin. So we were just discussing on the previous, on our minibus bill, you know, my point about how we're trying to balance access and quality. And I think you're trying to do that in this bill as well. And with the waiver of some of the requirements for coming back into the profession, could you just give us a little more information? What is it that people are going to not have to do that they would have previously done? And what makes you, or Representative Hewitt for that matter could answer, what makes you confident that people will have the skills if they've been out of the profession for a while? I mean, I understand that there will be oversight by a medical director, but we know that oversight can be close and it can be not so close. So maybe you could tell us kind of what that looks like in the context of this.
Yeah, great question, Madam Chair. They still have to come back in. So now as an old paramedic, every 2 years I'd have to go in and do a 48-hour refresher in advanced life support, cardiac care, trauma care, things like that, reading EKGs, given medications. So they have to go back and still complete that 48-hour refresher to validate to the state EMS board and the medical director that I still have the skill set and to update the skill set if some of those medications and treatment modalities have changed. And secondly, for the emergency medical technicians, like Representative Backer is, with the variances, that's 24 hours plus that they have to go back in and sit with a current state certified education facility and be sure that they've met the skill set to go back into the workforce.
Representative Hewitt?
Madam Chair, and the key to this component is the medical director. The medical director has to get eyes on them. And when I talked to the current EMSRB director, he said that's what we need is that medical director. It's not like we don't have a relationship with our medical directors. They all know who we are. We practice under their license. Well, not me anymore, but we did practice under their license. And that's so important that you have that component, because if he or she does not trust you, you're not getting on the ambulance. Plain, simple, straightforward. And I've been involved with situations where medical directors came and said, you're no longer practicing under my license, and that's a bad day. But that's the power of the medical director.
So just so I'm clear, what Mr. McAlpin was discussing is the current under the bill, or is that being waived under the bill?
Madam Chair, that's the current practices right now. So they'd have to continue to follow the current state statute.
Okay, so the bill doesn't remove that. It just allows them to come back in, do that update, and then get back on an ambulance?
Correct, Madam Chair.
Okay. Okay, other questions from members? Oh, Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry, Representative Hewitt, if I missed this. The amendment eliminates where there was ambulance service whose primary service area is mainly located outside of the metropolitan counties. Can you just remind, if you describe why we're pulling this specificity out of the bill? I missed it. Could you just refresh my memory?
Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And because the stakeholders brought this part of the bill to me, I'm going to let the stakeholders answer it, if it's okay, Madam Chair.
Okay. Mr. McAlpin.
Yeah, Madam Chair. And Representative Nadeau, that talks about the seven-county metro area, then Rochester, Mankato, I think up by Fargo, some of the bigger communities. The one reason we worked with everyone to eliminate that out of statute was mental health and interfacility transports are a big piece of what's decreasing 911 availability in communities. And we do think like we're allowing drivers in this bill for other ambulance services. We think it's better statewide if we have a uniform process that we apply to that. So if I go apply to the regulatory board for Mayo Clinic Ambulance in Mankato for a driver position or some of the larger communities, that's what we would want to have the ability to do that. And it's mostly for interfacility transfers.
Representative Nadeau?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, any other discussion? Not seeing any. Any closing words, Representative Hewitt?
Thank you, Chair Hill-Liebling, and thank you to the Health Committee. I know we've had some interesting hearings this year with this, so I appreciate your time. This really shows the urgency that we really need to put time into EMS, and I appreciate your support in these areas. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. With that, House File 4600, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. And Representative Backer, we have House File 4849. So Representative Backer is going to move that House File 4849 be laid over for possible inclusion. And I don't think you have any amendments, Representative.
I do not, Chair.
All right. So to your bill.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, members here. Pretty straightforward bill, in my opinion. One of the challenges that we have, this bill does not address who's in the back of the rig, like us EMTs and paramedics, but it does address who can drive the rigs. And it opens it up currently right now under our medical director. We have EMRs, that's emergency medical responders, with less training than EMTs who can drive. But there are scenarios that, for example, several times that has happened that it's hard to find an EMR to take call, number one. Or number two, for example, several years ago, we had a car with four passengers did a head-on collision with a semi. And we were overwhelmed extremely. I was the main EMT on that call. And at those calls, you do what you can. And we won't say what we had to do to make things happen because we probably didn't do some things correctly and who were driving. But we had to get out there and get all needed resources because our crew, our service, because we serve a 940-square-mile area, one of the largest in the state because we go into South Dakota, into the tribal nation of Sisseton-Wahpeton Tribe, we have two rigs. Now, if you look at that, we have four EMTs. When serious trauma runs happen, multiple vehicles, we get overwhelmed real quick. We only need two cars crashing, and we are maxed out right away. So we need other drivers. And what this does is it says, hey, firemen and firewomen, you can drive the ambulance, which we did during COVID, by the way. That's what we did during COVID to help during those times. Again, this applies direct pressure to the bleeding that we're having. It allows us to get the rigs out in those type of circumstances and so forth. Another good example, in my district this weekend, we have the girls in Grand County, West Central, down at the state playoff, Elbow Lake, Hoffman, Herman. They're not staffing. They don't have enough people to staff because they're all down to watching the game with their girls, which is understandable. One of my commissioners sent me a text from the EMS director from Elbow Lake saying, hopefully it's quiet because we don't have coverage in Hoffman. We have very poor coverage in Elbow Lake. So this helps us, and that's what it does. So I'll be happy for any questions or testifiers. So that's what this bill does. It allows firefighters to help drive with okay from the medical director because we're running under that person's license. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Backer. So is there anyone who wants to testify on this bill? Okay. I'm not seeing anyone. Is there a discussion? Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this goes to my last question, Representative Backer. So in this one, we're adding Section A under Subdivision 6, which provides the alternative staffing to the basic life support. And in the previous bill, House File 4600, we eliminated that from, we eliminated the carve-out for the metropolitan areas. But for the alternative staffing, I'm assuming that you're adding them back in here on purpose.
Yes.
Is that true, and can you talk to that?
Yeah, I can, because what we're...
Backer.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. As you know, I'm passionate about EMS, so I will jump in. That's what we're called to when the pager goes off. We jump to action. But Representative Nadeau, good question. This focuses on basic life support, so services like Browns Valley, like Henning, like Tower, Minnesota, who runs a basic life support system. So that's what we're addressing in this. Generally, when you get into Duluth, Mankato, Moorhead, Rochester, St. Cloud, you're a hospital system, and so forth. And my focus on this bill is helping those smaller ambulances that are county or city ran, that's totally volunteered or generally volunteered, and so forth. Like Henning is also in Ross, not Ross, they would be Elba Lake and stuff like that. Did that help?
Kind of.
Representative Nadeau. Kind of.
Madam Chair, thank you. And maybe this question is to House Research. Is the language in this bill, in Subdivision 6A, starting at 2.15, in conflict with what we just passed? And I don't know if I can even do this, ask about a previous bill, but they look like they're in conflict. We struck it out of one, and we're putting it back with a higher population in this one. Is that what we're doing?
Ms. Clark Fist.
Madam Chair and Representative Nadeau, I don't think they're necessarily in conflict. They're just creating two different kinds of alternative staffing models. This one is a straight alternative staffing model. The language that was in a Representative Hewitt's bill, you would have to get a variance from the board.
I see it.
So that's how I describe them.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Nadeau. Yeah. Yeah, I struggle with this stuff too because it's we got a lot of acronyms, there's a lot of complication to this whole system, and those of us who don't work with it every day have a problem sometimes. Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Backer. I'm just curious how the variance process works. Who asks whom for a variance? You mentioned here the board may grant a variance. Who do they call, and how does it happen, and how long does it last?
Sure.
Representative Backer.
Yes, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. They don't call the Ghostbusters, that's for sure. So, but on the serious note, generally, ambulance services, it can be done through the medical director. Mostly it's done by the manager, and they submit a request to the board for that variance. So generally it's done in jointly with the medical director, with the manager of the service, and then they make that formal request with the EMSRB board and so forth.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative. So this is something that they would be planning for. It wouldn't be Saturday, there's nobody there, and all of a sudden they need to run and they need the firefighter to do the drive. It would have been anticipated, or because I'm just thinking about who's in their office, mm-hmm. when to give approvals. Thanks.
Representative Backer?
Yeah, good question. Thank you. This is in advance, yeah, for readiness. For example, right now, the bill that I was chief author in 2015, and we changed it last year with the help of the chair, which I appreciate, allows us to work with other services, like when we weren't around, like what I talked about last year. We have to sign paperwork to get mutual aids and stuff. And this is not long-term. This is for 1 year. You know, so it would have to be renewed because, again, this is just it just helps solve a short-term problem. So this is pre-planned. We would discuss that. Like last night, I had an ambulance meeting over Zoom with our crew, with our medical director. We discussed things and what we should try for variants, and this would be one of the things we would agree upon, and then it would go up the chain. Pre-planned. Yeah, we want to, pager goes off, we don't want a situation that we're not ready. That is correct, Representative.
All right. Thank you, Representative Ryer. Representative Bonner.
Thank you. First of all, thanks, Madam Chair. And I just wanted to say, Representative Backer, I did actually have a somewhat similar question, so I will forego that because it seems like that got answered. And I will tell you, I'm actually really grateful for this bill. My grandfather was a member of the Bloomington Rescue Squad and then later in life moved up into northern Minnesota around Brainerd's Nisswa area. And I know he kept in close contact with folks over there. And this was an issue, right? And it has been for a long time, actually. So I really appreciate this bill. Thank you for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Representative Bonner. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to also mention that it's just really significant. We're right at the dire straight ends of employment. There's enough people to do these jobs. In Otter Tail County, we're getting huge fluxes of people coming there in the summer. And we have at times when I've been in some of my ambulance services, they say we are actually to a point we have to call in somebody else from another area. There just aren't the people. Workforce is really the problem, and this really helps alleviate some of that. These people are well, you know, they understand the area, they understand a lot of the services that we're delivering. These would be great people to have included. So it's just really dire in rural Minnesota.
Yeah, thank you. Any other discussion? All right, not seeing any. So any final word, Representative Backer?
Yeah, in regards with Representative Nadeau's thing, a question. Yeah, I do would agree we should try to match the two instead of having two different alternatives. And I will be working with Representative Hewitt. I kind of was thinking about the same thing a little bit, so you brought better light to it. Thank you. Again, I think everybody knows where I stand with EMS. The key thing is if any of you are in greater Minnesota and dial 911, you deserve the same amount of care that if you were in the metro area, and that's what I'm fighting for. So thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Very good. Well, thank you very much, Representative Backer. And just as a reminder to everybody, you know, we're laying this over, and that means we have a little bit of time that we can continue to work on it and if there's any, you know, harmonization that needs to happen between any of these things, we can work on that. So thank you very much for working on that and helping us out with this, Representative Backer. So with that, House Bill 4849 is laid over for possible inclusion. Okay.
I'm glad you wanted to vote yes.
You'll have your chance to vote yes on this. I also, also, I wanted to say that if anyone's keeping their bingo cards, you know, Ghostbusters, you could check that one off. Right? Okay. That's one for the bingo card. Okay, so the next bill on the agenda is House Bill 4853, Representative Bierman, and... So this is not actually before the committee. We actually don't have possession of this bill. It is, we will have possession like tomorrow because it is coming from the floor. But I wanted to take the opportunity today while we have the time to give an informational hearing to the bill. So the plan is that we will do that and then on Tuesday, we'll officially post the bill for Tuesday, and then I think the plan is to lay it over, right? So
correct, Madam Chair.
Okay, so does that what I just said sounds reasonable to you, Representative Bierman?
It does. Thank you.
Okay, very good. So Representative Bierman is not actually going to move his bill because, very oddly, even though we have the language, the number, and all that, we don't actually have the bill, although in actual fact, the way things are done these days, we never actually literally have the bill. So it's a very, very strange moment we're in with regard to legislative process. But be that as it may, Representative Bierman, please go ahead and describe your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members, for hearing House File 4853. Madam Chair, committee members, all of us have supported nonprofit health maintenance organizations for decades. HMOs were invented in Minnesota in 1973, and the pledge of the nonprofit HMOs has always been to exist as a charitable organization for the healthcare benefit of Minnesotans. These entities and how we regulate them in a complex and evolving healthcare marketplace have clear financial implications for all our citizens. An HMO conversion is the transfer of all or a substantial portion of a nonprofit health maintenance organization business or assets to a for-profit entity. This most commonly happens when a nonprofit is purchased by a for-profit entity. Members, conversions in other states unprepared for such transitions saw charitable assets removed from public benefit after years of public investment, making millions of dollars for the executives and very little for the people of their state. A strengthening of the rules and regulations pertaining to conversions are needed in this state to avoid the public asset loss that has occurred elsewhere. This bill creates a robust safeguards around conversions for the public interest, including a transparent public process, a full and fair market value assessment of the public benefit assets to be preserved for the public good. The bill assigns the Attorney General as the current protector of charitable assets in Minnesota presently to ensure that these public assets from conversions are utilized as designated to advance the future health care interests of Minnesotans. The Minnesota Department of Health is the regulator of Minnesota HMOs, but they receive far less information and oversight than the Department of Commerce has over health insurers. This bill updates the sight lines of MDH to regulate both nonprofit and the new for-profit HMOs allowed to operate in the state. So far, this bill has moved through Commerce and Judiciary, and I look forward to the questions here, even though we don't have the bill, and would like to also invite testifiers, please, Madam Chair.
Yes, thank you very much, Representative Bierman. So first we have on the list Lynn Nelson from Blue Cross Blue Shield. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lynn Nelson, Vice President of Public Affairs for Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota. For 90 years, Minnesota, more than 90 years actually, Blue Cross has been carrying out its mission to pave the way for all Minnesotans to live their healthiest life. As a nonprofit, taxable organization, Blue Cross is a leading health plan in Minnesota, covering 2.5 million members in all 87 counties in Minnesota. As our mission implies, we not only serve our members, but all Minnesotans, in the fact that we took on big tobacco with the state of Minnesota. And we support and advocated for universal meals in schools, which benefits all Minnesotans. We urge caution regarding the current bill language on House File 4853. As it appears premature, given the final HMO study by the Minnesota Department of Health will not be complete until July 1st of 2024. While the preliminary report offers valuable insights into the history and current state of HMOs in Minnesota, it repeatedly emphasizes the need for further analysis before specific recommendations can be made regarding the classification of public assets and other regulatory structures. Blue Cross has consistently advocated for a level playing field in this space, not only between nonprofits and for-profits, but also across nonprofit entities. Therefore, we recommend a pause on this legislation until the Minnesota Department of Health completes the final study that this committee required just last session. This approach will ensure that any regulations implemented are well-informed and equitable for all stakeholders involved. Thank you for considering our perspective on this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Rachel Hanneman. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Hello, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Rachel Hanneman, and I'm a BSN nurse who works in the ER and in the ICU at Fairview Southdale, and I'm testifying in support of HF 4853. For the last 2 years, I've been organizing, speaking out publicly, and coming forward to committee hearings like this one to help shed light on the woeful realities of our current state of health care and in hospitals across our state. As someone who has worked directly at the bedside since 2011 providing care to patients, I can assure you that none of what my fellow nurses and I have been sharing on topics like unsafe staffing, workplace violence in hospitals and unit closures have been isolated incidents. Profit-driven motives are harming healthcare delivery in Minnesota as we speak. We see this most directly in our homegrown United Health Group, where patients are being denied life-saving care because this insurance company has somehow gotten away with participating in healthcare industries even while refusing to provide payments for necessary medical services. We know this happens throughout the private insurance industry now and can only get worse without intervention. I had one patient at Fairview tell me that she's unable to have a cardiac procedure because her insurance has not authorized it and she cannot pay out of pocket despite the fact that she needs to have this procedure. We've seen what happens when CEOs are given an inch. They hire an army of lawyers to make it a mile, which they'll then turn around and bill for you. Meanwhile, the taxpayers of Minnesota end up absorbing the cost of these tax breaks these entities receive, along with other handouts they get through municipal bonding or reinsurance. We need to ensure that the taxpayer dollars invested in our nonprofit health insurance companies are not used to convert into for-profit companies or offshoots and further degrade the healthcare access and affordability. Though MNA fully supports the ban on for-profit insurance in our state and proposed elsewhere, we know that such regulations are vulnerable to be overturned, so we need protections in place to protect our taxpayer-funded investments that this bill provides. Words like consolidated, accelerated, and benchmarked were never in any of the textbooks I read while I was studying to become a nurse. Those words were taken from the dialect of accountants, marketing professionals, and big legal firms and private equity corporations, none of whom will be there for you at 2 a.m. when you come to the hospital for chest pain and when you need care. We need to place our focus on health care that is affordable, accessible, and results-driven. That provides the quality care that every person across the state of Minnesota deserves. We can do this by eliminating opportunities for rich CEOs to continue to shape our healthcare through Minnesota and business deals behind closed doors. Please support HF 4853 as it is a step in the right direction, and we thank Representative Bierman for carrying it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Robert Hader. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Robert Hyder, and I'm the legislative director at Take Action Minnesota. We are a people-centered, multiracial people's organization that believes in a democracy and government that works for us all. For over 15 years, Take Action has worked to promote a people-centered healthcare system. I am here today to share our strong support for House File 4853 once it gets to your committee. We have an opportunity to learn from experiences in other states, many of whom did not pass conversion regulations until many public benefit assets had already been stripped in the name of corporate greed. In California, a $3 billion transfer of assets to two foundations came about after Blue Cross initially offered to donate only $100 million to charity. Thanks to strong conversion regulations, they ensured all of those assets remained a public benefit. Because of conversion protections in Maryland, the insurance commissioner there was able to review the transaction when WellPoint tried to buy CareFirst and hold public hearings around the state. There they uncovered that $75 million was set to go to corporate executives. That conversion was found to be not in the public interest and it was denied. In Ohio, a controversial conversion proposal from one nonprofit inspired conversion legislation that was employed in a subsequent merger between a nonprofit and Anthem. But the review of the merger was not open to the public, only $28 million in assets were protected, and the board of the new foundation included the for-profit insurer. A lot is at stake in getting this right, and these examples point to the importance of four things, all of which this bill does well. The Attorney General has the opportunity to review conversions, gather independent assessment of value, and protect public assets for the public interest. The public has the opportunity to have input into those decisions. The governance of the resulting conversion benefit entity is independent and responsive to community needs, and the Department of Health is notified of a broader set of transactions so that they can analyze trends and be alert to emerging concerns and gaps in regulations. We urge you to support the regulations and the consumer protections authorized in this bill to ensure that public assets are used for the public good and not converted to corporate profits. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. So those are all the folks that signed up ahead of the hearing, but is there anyone else who wants to testify on the bill? And if you notice, we're not keeping people to 2 minutes, so there is opportunity here.
I'll get on the list.
Oh, that's right. You're always on the list, Representative Plump.
We can help you.
Okay, I don't see anyone rushing to come down and talk about the bill. So, member discussion. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Representative Bierman. And you've been wonderful in reaching out and sharing with me, and I appreciate that. And I don't think any of my questions will come as a surprise to you. So, as I read this, as we know, a study was directed in the last legislative session. We've gotten the first part of that. The second part is not due out until the end of June. And again, that second portion is supposed to include legislative recommendations for us. This bill came out last week. It started out as a 30-page bill. It's now a 15-page bill. There's been a lot of change and adjustment. From a process perspective, why are we not waiting for the actual study to be completed so that we have the data, we have the information, and we have those legislative recommendations from the folks who should be experts, right? Who should know what they're talking about, particularly by the time the study is completed.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative New Brindley. Very good question. And I'm sure you read the whole report as I did. And in that report, there are definitely, I mean, this is a very complex issue, but there are definitely on page 54 of the draft, some of the things that they talk about in that report of what needs to be done. And this bill is not trying to tackle this whole issue in one bill that would be comprehensive to the point of no need to follow up. This is starting with some of the very fundamental principles identified in the report of what are the first steps we need to do. And I think that some of those first steps, we don't need to wait for the rest of the report. There are things coming in the second part of that report that I really, really am curious about and want to learn more about. But, you know, identifying regulatory practices for conversion transactions that have worked in other states, like the example Mr. Heider presented about California, that's pretty fundamental. That's a starting point. That's already begun. Establishing a valuation process for public assets, that's pretty straightforward too, and the stewardship of them. So, you know, the last thing, and I'll say is the, well, two more things. The public process, putting that into law and making it public interest, I don't think we need to wait for a report to realize that that's an important step in this process. And then also just getting the Attorney General's office involved as a public interest and the final sort of oversight of charitable assets, this relates to him, and that is what has proven in other states to make these conversion transactions the most effective. And so we've taken those four steps in this bill, and we have much, much more to do. They recommend, you know, a deeper dive into for-profit and foreign-domiciled HMOs that are operating in Minnesota or will operate in Minnesota. I think that's a critical thing that's going to come with further study, and I think that's something that I'll be interested to really follow and learn more about how that's done, because we presently have a for-profit and nonprofit market. And I've talked to the insurance companies, and there's a real concern about competing in the future with both of those. When that allowance for for-profit entities came into Minnesota, there was not a robust, active structure put in place. And so it's time for that to happen. We don't need to wait another year to do the things of this bill and get the report and to continue doing more work on this area in the next session. So I think that we've waited long enough. We need to secure the protection of these assets. We can do this. This is something that I've actually wanted to do since my first year up here, and I learned from Representative Schultz about this particular issue and the 2017 event that sort of happened in the dark of night, if you will. And, you know, we have some follow-up we can do right now, and I think it's incumbent upon all of us. That's our job up here, is to take care of public interest and public safety, and this certainly falls in that purview. So I don't think we need to wait. We need to pass this bill.
Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have read most of the report. I haven't gotten quite through all of it. But I am looking at page 54. That you referenced, mm-hmm. And it literally says, looking ahead, this is what the final report's going to give us. It's going to include all of this information. And that's information that we don't have right now. We don't have that information as a whole. We have bits and pieces, but we don't have it. And these are really monumental changes that we're making. These are really, really significant changes that we're making. You're the ones that commissioned the report. It wasn't even us. But you're not looking to use the report that you asked for, which seems like a really irresponsible way to do business. You have referenced a number of times the public assets, and I do want to get into that just a little bit.
Representative Brindley, I think we should let him respond to that if
you're
going to sort
fine.
Of change subjects.
Certainly, because certainly.
That was kind of a, you know, to I think, you know, when you're accusing him or us of being irresponsible, I think he deserves an opportunity
great.
To respond. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think the first part of what I said initially covers the fact that this information is multifaceted. But again, you can read the report in full, and they highlight the areas that other states have done and these first fundamental steps. And that's what we are taking, are those first fundamental steps that I don't believe will change when we get the final report, because they're going into a deeper dive on some of those issues. And so I'm not going to, you know, the final topics of how to handle foreign domiciled entities. I'm not going to how a holding company transfers funds between itself to cover, you know, risk-based capital issues. I'm not going into things like what happens when a Minnesota domiciled or a holding company takes assets and moves them out of state. I mean, there's a lot of issues there that we're going to have to tackle in the future. But these first ones about getting it set up and getting a regulatory process in place and getting MDH the sight lines they need to have oversight and getting the AG on board to be able to review these, those can all happen now. Thank you.
Thank you. Second part of your question, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I will just say the problem with this bill lies in your response right there. We don't believe, but we don't know. We don't have the report. So that's it lies in the response.
Madam Chair, I would just like to say the proverbial we, for me, is the people of Minnesota.
Thank you, Madam.
Okay. All right. Let's go on to the next topic that you wanted
great.
To raise, Representative.
The concern is not with the we, it's with the we believe. It's belief rather than knowledge, and the report gives us knowledge. So the other question I would have, again, this should come as no surprise. It was my concern with the similar bill passed last year, is on the very broad definition of public assets in the bill. And I look at lines 1.14 to 1.16, and the public benefit assets are defined as the entirety of a nonprofit health coverage entity's assets, including anticipated future revenue. It is extremely broad, and I'm wondering if you can talk to us a little bit on how you see that playing out. What is included in that very broad definition of public assets?
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the very broad definition is HMOs were created to be nonprofit entities whose assets were to ensure and be utilized for the health of Minnesotans. That is a rather all-encompassing statement. So that's where I see that entirety of the assets being included for the benefit of the health care of Minnesotans.
Representative Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as I look at this, I brought this up during the bill on the House floor last year. You know, I mean, we're looking, and I get it, where it wasn't specifically the Sanford-Fairview merger, but we all know that that's what was being affected at the time. And we talked about the hospitals, for example. And one of the hospitals had significant public investment. One of the hospitals had never been owned by the state. It had always been owned by the private entity. And yet, as we talked about those public assets, we talked about both of those hospitals as public assets, which they weren't. And in fact, if we were going to discuss the hospital that had significant state investment, it had been sold to a private entity almost 30 years previously. That would have been the appropriate time to talk about the public investment. So I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on what makes this difference. I mean, we invested over $1 billion last year of state money into different nonprofits. What makes, and interestingly, this is discussed as though we are making investments in these nonprofits the same way, which we are not. These nonprofits are being run as businesses with strict controls. We're not just giving them money to operate, right? Like we are paying them in a contractual way to provide a service to the state of Minnesota. And yet we are treating these assets very differently than we do all these other nonprofits that we literally gave over $1 billion to last year of direct money, just giving to nonprofits, not in a contractual way with the state of Minnesota. Can you talk about that just a little bit, please?
Madam
Representative
Chair?
Bierman.
And I'll be very brief, because I'm not talking about all of those nonprofits and whatever organizations you're going after there. We are talking about health maintenance organizations that are nonprofit and were created in Minnesota decades ago and have been dedicated to public programs in Minnesota and have had certain consequential tax benefits. And operating as a nonprofit charitable organization dedicated to the better health and improved health of Minnesotans. So that's really very narrow what I'm talking about. And that was the deal when they started, was assets would be put back into the community for the better health of Minnesotans. And that's what we are asserting is what their manner of operation is, and strictly that. And so it's pretty narrow on HMOs in that refined way.
And I would just note that that is stated in law, and I was just kind of looking at Ms. Clarkvist. I don't know if she could quickly find that provision. Mm. It was actually repealed when the Republicans were in the majority, and then Democrats, I believe, put it back in, but I think she must know what I mean. There's a provision in law that actually states the mission of the HMOs. Anything further, Representative Brindley?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and now I will be brief. I want to be very clear. I'm not interested in going after any other nonprofit entity either, except, of course, the ones who have committed document fraud in our state. I'm very interested in going after those. I'm not interested in going after them either. And you talk about consequential tax benefits. These are IRS rules. Every nonprofit has access to those tax benefits of a nonprofit status. What is interesting, and I think very dangerous, is that we are philosophically going after assets that don't belong to us. We have made contracts with private businesses, regardless of what their status is. We have entered into contracts with private businesses to offer a service, and they've done so according to those contracts. And now we are saying, yeah, but you don't get to benefit from the fruits of that service that you have provided. You don't get to make your own decisions on the best way to operate. You don't get to do these things. And I think it's problematic that we are treating them so differently than we treat any of these other entities. And ultimately, here's the deal. Ultimately, it's the state of Minnesota, mostly. I mean, you know, ERISA plans are 40%. It's, you know, I mean, there are different sort of governance happening in all of these different entities. But for the most part, the concern is where the state of Minnesota is engaged. And we're treating them very differently than we do anyone else. And I have real concerns about that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Ms. Clarkfist, were you able to find that provision?
Madam Chair and members, I think the language you're referring to is in Section 62D.12, Subdivision 8A. And it says all net earnings of a nonprofit HMO must be devoted to the nonprofit purposes of the HMO in providing comprehensive health care. And then there's further text as well.
Yes, thank you. That is indeed it. And that, I believe, was, as Representative Bierman was describing, part of the, I don't know when that was originally passed, but it's been a kind of foundational to the HMOs in Minnesota. That they had this nonprofit mission and were supposed to dedicate their resources to the health of Minnesotans. Okay. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Bierman. You always take on these complicated topics, and I enjoy the thought that you put into the work that you do. I do, Representative Brindley, I really do think it hits. She's hitting the key, at least where I'm coming from. She's really hitting the key of this issue. And I don't think it matters if it's HMOs, if it's nonprofit school-based mental health providers. There's a massive group of people that the state and the counties that we retain. And we enter into those contractual obligations to pay for a service that we dictate how much we're actually going to reimburse at. Representative Bernie started talking about the consequential tax benefits, and you brought it up originally. And those, what we do there is we provide those expenditures, be it in HMOs, be it in housing tax credits. We do that so that it drives down the cost of that public benefit that we're all paying for. We, as in the collective we. And I'm having a hard time getting my head wrapped around that. What is that public asset that we're working very hard here to try to define? Is it retained knowledge? I mean, is it? What is it? They're providing a service that we're dictating the payment for. They're taking a risk, and I would submit that, you know, a long time ago when HMO when this whole thing started, I mean, we were so successful at the time because it was this very partnership-based approach, very organic, not that regulatory. It was, we have a problem, and the state worked very, very closely with those partners to build a system that honestly led the nation for a long time. We were an example of that. And I'm not here to just try to defend HMOs. I'm really trying to understand how and the thought process of defining this public asset. I mean, I have other questions that I'm going to wait until next week when we have, more specifically to the language of the bill. But can you just help me get my head wrapped around better with what Representative Brindley started? I think that's the heart of this bill.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Nadeau, for the good questions. And it is a really complex thing. I mean, to figure out the valuation, you really would need a third party to come in and do that, to really value the assets of an HMO. And it is comprehensive over time. I mean, they've been in business for a long time. They've made some money, maybe the most in the last couple of years, where they've had some cash flow for the entity. But there's not a lot of insight into where that money potentially could go, and that's one of the things in the later in the report for June we're going to learn more about and take a deeper dive into that and really understand this whole model better. It's a convoluted, complex financial entity, a lot of transactions that would have to be overseen and overlooked or have that oversight for. But fundamentally, I would keep coming back to, you know, you mentioned at the start when they were first formed and what their purpose was, and they were, you know, organic and easy to follow and track. It's a whole lot more complicated now with the marketplace of healthcare and the very nature of a profit system entwined with these companies that have a portion that is a nonprofit HMO. So there's transactions back and forth, and that all plays into it. But it comes back to, you know, the valuation part of that, I think, is critical, and that's something that it would have to be the Department of Health and the Attorney General who will really look at charitable entities and make those determinations of what is and what should be analyzed, and also especially commerce, because commerce has at presently better sight lines into the insurance industry, but there's not enough sight lines into the HMO portion of that and how it affects public plans being non-charitable, dedicated to the public health of Minnesotans. And so that's part of this further work.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Bierman, for the work that you're doing on this. And it's a very important area that we take a look at as you're talking about the charitable part, because when we take a look at charity, when we take a look at nonprofit work, that in regular nonprofits that are out there, when they dissolve or they go away, they have to take all their assets, remaining assets, and give it to another tax-exempt company or federal government, state, or local government for a public purpose. That's what's required right now. And I think what you're talking about is getting to the very heart of that, is these organizations were dedicated originally with those same purposes as a regular nonprofit charity. And as a result, any assets that are in there that became because of that core profit or core purpose should then go back to the public purpose that it originally came from, as we do with every other nonprofit that is out there. So I think this is something that's very important. It's something that I know many other nonprofits have followed. I've seen nonprofits that have gone out of business, and the remaining assets were given to other nonprofits as they continue the public good, public purpose out there, which is what you're addressing in your bill. Thank you.
And Representative Nadeau, yet another follow-up?
Oh.
Go ahead. I know that Fisher wanted to get in on
really,
the conversation.
It's really a quick one. We know about the Fairview and Sanford thing that kind of fell through, but I mean, has there ever been an HMO merger acquisition where they wanted to jettison a particular business line in Minnesota? I know that there was a testifier that talked about some other states where this has occurred, but has it happened in Minnesota?
Representative Bierman.
So not on the scale that we've seen in other areas. When I first came in that first year, there were issues about one provider moving money from their nonprofit to another state, and that was kind of what kind of alerted me to this whole issue. We haven't had a merger that I'm aware of on a large scale of HMO to HMO, but that's not to say that if we don't do anything, you won't read about it in the newspaper next month.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Nadeau. Okay, looks like maybe people are hungry. Oh, maybe not. Representative Nabrim?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just say, I mean, since 2017, we did have this. Preferred One was purchased. So, and there weren't big news stories. It wasn't a problem. It actually has not been an issue. So just to your point, yes, it has happened, and it has happened in the state in very recent years. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Right. Representative Bierman, I recall, I mean, Preferred One, I think, was a smallish company on the scheme of things. But Representative Bierman?
Yeah, Madam Chair, yeah, agreed. I mean, when you look at what has happened, transpired across the nation, it was pretty small comparatively.
Okay. Okay, I guess we're not hungry. Representative Quam.
Well, the last comment, there hasn't been, and then when an example is brought up, oh, that was small, we can disregard it. Either there has or hasn't, and the example in Minnesota that has happened didn't have this horrid thing happen. I know there are a lot of things in other states that Minnesota sometimes copies, and frequently other states have mistakes and bad things. But looking at Minnesota, which led in the HMO introduction and development, I think we've done a better job, and we really need to address the causes of all the financial headaches we're having in our healthcare system instead of trying to address small little effects out of that, because system-wide we've got major problems, and that's where the focus should be. And every time we say, well, we're going to do a study, we actually, if we're going to do a study, do it and actually look at it. Otherwise, what are we doing the studies for? And assumptions don't always track with the facts, but if you get the facts and the data, I'm sort of lean towards facts and data, you can make a better choice of which path to go forward. So I look forward to the hours of additional debate when we actually get this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
So just to conclude, and I'll let Representative Bierman have the final word, but I feel like Representative Bierman answers that question repeatedly, and then we keep hearing people talk about it as though he never said anything in response. I'm a little bit confused by that. But the one piece that I want to add here is that, you know, in our, we, of course, use HMOs to deliver a lot of our public health care programs in this state. And the rules, we haven't had a price bid, by the way, for a number of years in terms of the procurement process for, you know, picking companies to be the providers under our, or the insurers under our health care programs. We haven't been doing price bids, but the law, as I understand it, requires the rates that we pay them to be actuarially sound. In other words, you know, it's not an arm's length really thing. You know, contrary to what's been sort of purveyed here, it's not like they're just some random company and it's an arm's length transaction and we're hiring them and they're doing so. No, that's not the way it works. We have to make sure that they remain whole and pay them enough to keep them whole. And at the same time, we don't always have really good sight lines, at least we in the legislature sure don't, really good sight lines into where that money is flowing and what that actually means, actuarially sound. So I just wanted to add that. And also, I'll let you have the final word, Representative Bierman, but I just am so appreciative of your work. And Minnesotans watching, if there are watching, should be very appreciative, because you obviously spend an enormous amount of time digging into understanding this complex topic and, as members have said, visiting with members and talking to all kinds of folks about what you're doing, what you're working on. And that is not an easy task. So thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I look forward to the further conversation with everybody on this issue. It's a big issue. We should be solving it together. It is an important aspect of our health care dilemma in this country, and particularly this one in Minnesota. So appreciate the time, look forward to further conversation and learning from you all and the departments and the agencies and the insurance companies. So thank you.
All right, well, thank you. So the bill is not laid over because it is not before us, but the discussion of that is concluded and we are adjourned.